Welcome to the Valley College Connection, where John Kawai and Scott Wigand, two Valley professors, engage in a conversation about success with educators and students. Each week, they'll sit down with a different guest to find out ways each of us have had to plan, persevere, and overcome to where we are now. The show will also highlight resources and services that are working to make a difference at Valley College.
We are joined this afternoon by Ron Reese, former technology department chair and professor of electronics at Los Angeles Valley College. Thank you so much for joining us, Ron.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
Ron, we wanted to hear your story and path of how you got to Valley College. We'd like to start off as far back as you want to share. If you want to talk about where you grew up at, where you went to, you know, elementary, middle school, high school, what the path was that brought you to Valley, we'd like to hear all of it.
Okay, I'd be glad to help you with that. My path to Valley College was really straightforward and simple. I went from Van Nuys High School, where I graduated in 1959, straight over to Valley College. Just about everybody at Van Nuys High School seemed to be going to Valley College at that time. I graduated with the largest graduating class of any high school west of the Mississippi. We had 1,300 in our graduating class and 5,200 students at Van Nuys High School at the time. And it was a post-Sputnik time when everybody was going to college to beat the Russians in space and to the moon. We were scared to death that we were falling behind. And so everybody had a career to go after in college, and particularly a technical career or a scientific career. And Valley College was wide open to us. I went with my twin brother at the time. We were so grateful that Valley was there for us. We could have gone on to a state college perhaps or whatever, but Valley was open and welcoming with all its bungalows. In fact, I went there in the summer of 1959 to take a course in health, a Health 10 course, just to get used to the campus. And the only thing on that campus at that time were what they finally tore down, which were the bungalows. When I took the class in the summer of that time, the teacher said, or the professor said, "Don't worry, this is temporary. We're going to get rid of these bungalows." And he was right, but it took 60 years to do it. Anyway, I enjoyed myself there. I took this health class. I got used to what was going on campus. And then in the fall, the engineering building opened up. And I claim to this day, and I sure tell my students this, that on Monday, I had a class at 8 o'clock in that engineering building. And I claim to have been one of the first students in that building. And that's where I've been teaching more or less for the last for the 25 years I've been at Valley College.
Well, Ron, let me pull you back a little bit. So were you always thinking engineering when you were in high school or in junior high?
Absolutely not. I was thinking science. I was a member, along with my brother, of what was called the Science Explorer Scouts. We were the first one in the nation, sponsored by Marcraft Air Corps. But no, I wasn't thinking that. In fact, when I was in high school, I wanted to be an architect. But in my senior year, the counselor put me in this electronics class, and I looked around. It was like a big closet. We saw World War II videos of electrons running around in the wires and so on, and I got a C in the class. I graduated with a C. I finished the class with a grade of a C, and so I tell my students today, I was not born with a capacitor in my hand or electronics. It came later to me. It came in college. That's when I got interested in it. And for many of my students today, that's when they're getting interested in it too.
So, and then when you came over here, were you comfortable with academics? Did you do well? Did you meet, were the professors that were meaningful that you met on campus?
There were indeed. I mean, as far as the latter one part, I'm not sure about the first part. I did all right, okay? I told my students just recently that when I graduated from college with a bachelor's degree, I graduated with a 3.1 grade point average, and 90% of my grades were Bs. I got very few As, but I also got very few Cs or Ds. I was just a B student, and I had to work at it to get there. My brother has a bachelor's degree, two bachelor's degrees, one in physics, one in geology, two master's degrees, and a PhD in physics from Stanford. But he does not have an associate degree like me. And my father once said to me, bless his heart, how come you have to study so hard and your brother just sails right through? And I said to my dad, I don't know, but that's it. I have to work at it. That's the way it is. So, and so do my students in many cases. I think I can relate to them in that regard.
What were your other classes like when you were there at Valley College, Ron? So
well, I did take math classes, and there was, what was that instructor that was, I came to Valley as an instructor in 1996 from Trade Tech. I was there at Trade Tech for 13 years or 12 years. What was his name? He was original math instructor, original.
Is it Mazier or something like that?
Go ahead.
Was it something like
say it?
Mazier? I think we named the. I know we have a scholarship based off of his name. We have a scholarship based off of his name.
Leon.
Yeah, it was like Mazier or Marzier, but he was supposed to be a very groundbreaking and influential guy who was the first chair for a very long time.
Yeah, well, all right, that's not the guy. But the guy I had was good, and I liked him. And then there was also a guy named Kinzik. And you could turn in you could do a test, get every problem right, and he'd hand it back with a 65 grade on it or something because you didn't lay it out exactly like he wanted on the sheet of paper. Anyway, I got through my math classes all right and any of the other classes. When I was taking courses at Valley, yeah, most of them were science and technical courses. But the course that really helped, I enjoyed and was a real break for me is I remember taking these math classes, the physics classes, the chemistry, all that sort of stuff. And then I took this art history class in the middle of the day, so to speak. And we'd go into a bungalow there. The teacher would turn off the lights and she'd show us slides of all these great artwork from Europe, you know, and so forth. And it was such a break. It was such a nice calming effect compared to all the other courses I'm taking. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Sure, absolutely.
It was a break and I really enjoyed that. But the thing I remember most about Valley College at that time was we had 24,000 students at one time. That
wow,
24,000 students at one time. Again, think of the high school had 5,200 students. The thing I remember most about Valley was the enthusiasm that people had for being there and going ahead and so on. And I didn't have a bad instructor. I did not have an instructor I didn't admire or was thankful to have.
So how did that transition to electronics or engineering happen? Was that at Valley College?
Yeah, there was some of it at Valley College. Then I went to Cal State LA, and I decided that that would be a good career to beat the Russians to the moon. So I graduated from from Cal State LA in 1964 with a bachelor's degree in electronics. And then I joined the Peace Corps. And I went to Malaysia, spent 2 years in Malaysia, came back. Before I left Malaysia, I broke up with this girl. Her name was Karen, cute little girl, and I broke up with her. But after I got to Malaysia, I started to get letters from her. And what had happened is her mother had decided that I was too old for her. I started dating her when I was 18 and she was 15, and she thought that was too much. So she broke us up. But then I got a letter from her, the Karen, about 4 or 5 months after I was in Malaysia. And it turns out that Karen was 18, 19, and dating a guy who was 36 years old, twice her age. And her mom thought that, well, maybe she should write to me. Well, that girl, Karen, and I have been married for 54 years now. And she came to my graduation at Valley College from an associate degree. Anyway, we're here. And my mother-in-law, bless her heart, she's 100 years old, and she still can tell that story.
So she's on your side now, huh?
She's on my side. Yeah, I'm her favorite son-in-law.
Oh, good. Well, let me ask you this. Tell me about the Peace Corps, because I've always been fascinated by it.
Yeah, well, Malaysia was considered the country club of the Peace Corps.
And well, why don't you explain what the Peace Corps is for people who don't know?
Yeah, well, it was a volunteer organization set up by Kennedy, where a person would volunteer for 2 years. They trained for a few months. We trained in Hawaii, and would go to these countries and learn the language, you know, training before we got there, and do what we did. And in my case, since I had a technical background, I was placed in what was called the Sekolah Lanjutan Kampong, which was a rural equivalent to our junior high school. I had to teach in Malay, in the Malay language, the Bahasa Melayu. And I spent a year there. Then I spent a year at a rehabilitation school in the near the capital, and then at a college in the capital, which would be equivalent to our 12th and 13th grade, a two-year college. It was a nice place to be. Malaysia was a nice. It wasn't like there was Nepal, for example, which was considered a real rough rough posting, and you had to really have some good language skills, and it was tough there. But they decided to post me to Malaysia. So,
how'd you come to pick the Peace Corps? Because usually that's an East Coast private school thing.
No, I don't know. I never thought of it that way. It was Kennedy thing. I filled out my application in the fall, in November of 1963, and I came. I was staying, living at home, still going to college, and I came home one day. My mom was sitting in bed with an atlas opened up, and she's kind of crying a little bit. She said, "What?" He said, "You got a telegram from Sergeant Shriver. You're going to Malaya." Malaysia at the time. I'm trying to figure out where that is.
Did you ever meet him?
No, I never met him.
Okay. I've heard so many stories about him back in the day.
Well, in the beginning, he would phone. He would call you. And then later on, he would send telegrams. That's when I was there. Then, of course, it all bogged down. But there are ex-volunteers around. Doug Marriott's was a volunteer twice in Dominican Republic.
And I know I have such respect for anyone who does Peace Corps. It's such a wonderful volunteerism.
Yeah, it was a good experience, and
So, what happened after the Peace Corps?
Came back. And my girlfriend, Karen, now was, she decided we should be getting married pretty soon. And I said, "Oh, well, all right." And she said, "Well, if we're going to get married, you really should work." And, you know, I was planning to go to graduate school and all that sort of stuff. So she had some better ideas. And I worked for a while in industry, did a few things like that. Then I got a job teaching, electronics at Burbank High School. And we were married in 1966. My job at Burbank High School, the first year I was there, I was paid $5,200 a year. A year. But of course, gas was 19 cents a gallon at the time. I enjoyed teaching electronics. I really got into it once we went to digital and we got to smaller components and so forth and so on. But I left in 1980, and I went to work in industry, a number of different jobs. I was a technical writer for a Transaction Technology Corporation, which was a branch of Citicorp. Did all their technical writing there. I mean, I was just one of many technical writers. I was a printed circuit board designer for Hughes. I did some kit design and this sort of thing. And then somebody came along and said to me, a friend of mine said to me, who was teaching at LA Trade Tech. He says, "Why don't you get back into teaching?" I said, "Oh, you never couldn't pay me. You know, I'd have to take a big cut." But it turned out I didn't have to take a big cut. And I went to Trade Tech in 1984 and came over to Valley College in 1996.
Wow. So back then, the professor, these positions, teaching positions, were competitive with aerospace?
Well, you know, with the summer off and all of that, and then that's when I started doing some writing, some technical writing for textbooks, you know, and that sort of thing. And what with that and everything, it was competitive. Yeah.
So once you went to trade tech. You started as a full-timer, or did you start as a part-timer and then transition?
Actually, I think I think in the spring of 1994, I taught one class at night, but it was understood I was coming there in the fall. And then in the fall, I did start full-time. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then did you enjoy the work more in terms of teaching, or do you miss some of the, I guess, building that you did when you were working in industry?
Well, you know, as we all know, I mean, teaching allows you an opportunity to do both, really, in some ways. And I would do some consulting, to be sure, and some extra stuff like that. But no, but I considered my full-time job to be teaching. There was no question about it. And that was a time when we had, it was a golden age of teaching electronics. We had students, unbelievable number of students that were coming in. We had 60 in a class and that sort of thing. Part of it was this Vietnamese boat people surge that came in. And what was interesting about that is half of those students were female.
The
other half, of course, were obviously male. But, I mean, that was an unusual time in which the Vietnamese, bless their hearts, they didn't seem to have any hang up about that. Gender-wise, and half the students were female. And with that coming in we had students coming out of our years. There were 18 full-time faculty in the electronics department at Trade Tech when I arrived in 1994. Mm-hmm. It was the largest electronics program at a community college anywhere in the United States.
So let's explain to listeners who the boat people were and why they were Vietnamese.
Okay. Many of them were, of course, they were from Vietnam, but not all of them were Vietnamese. Many of them were Chinese. And Chinese, as I'm sure my listeners know, and many of them are Chinese, were what were called overseas Chinese. And overseas Chinese in the United States, true, but they were also in Malaysia, they're Singapore, and Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia. There was always a large segment of Chinese who were very well educated and very entrepreneurial and so on. Some of them have families going back 300 or 400 years. And yet there was clearly various resentments by the, quote, local population or native population. Certainly was true in Malaysia. And so many of them left when they could. And left after the war, the Vietnam War, and so on. I remember I had a wonderful Chinese student in my class at Trade Tech who left on a boat. He and his family, his sisters, left on a boat, went to the Philippines, were in a camp in the Philippines for a year, and so on, and then were sent to the east coast of Malaysia. And the Malaysian, very rural, very conservative, nativist Malaysians, and they wouldn't let the boat land, and his two identical twin sisters drowned right out there. But he was a wonderful guy.
I guess you would compare it a lot to what's happening with Cuba, where people were trying to escape sort of the communism and also look for opportunity.
Absolutely.
And they're, you know, and there are political issues of sometimes Cubans are allowed in, but the Haitians aren't. And there was a lot of organizations that went and then would sponsor some of the people who managed to land somewhere in Asia where they would take them as a refugee. And a lot of them came to the United States because they would find a church to sponsor them to
Exactly.
Right.
It's basically the same thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And then I have friends that were in that sort of, so that generation are people that are about my age or a little bit younger, a little bit older.
And then you know, they went through the system and they graduated and did their thing and went to work and so on and so forth. And many of them continue to live in California and you know, down south a bit from us and, Orange County and whatnot. Mm-hmm.
So when you were at Trade Tech, was the Cold War still going on or did the wall come down?
Well, it had come down. Yeah. That kind of broke up in 1989, in 1991, that kind of thing. So when I left, it happened while I was at Trade Tech. I was at Trade Tech from 84 to 96. And so many of our students were getting good jobs in the aerospace industry. You had to be a citizen, however. That was a bit of an issue. But many of them got jobs. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think a lot of that issue of citizenship was because you need to get pass a security clearance.
Security clearance, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think it looks like you came to Trade Tech at a good time because mm-hmm. I remember I was going to school in the late 80s, right before the wall fell down. And I remember at the time they were telling all of us at the same time, and be an engineer, aerospace will always be here, there will always be a job. And in between when my friends became mechanical engineers and electrical engineers, between their freshman and year and graduation, the wall mm-hmm. came down and there were no jobs. So literally the senior year was when the wall came down and everyone got fired in aerospace.
It's been a rocky road in aerospace since the war, since World War II. I mean, as you well know, ups and downs. There are bus driver, I remember at Burbank High when I was taking kids on a field trip, the bus driver had a master's degree in electrical engineering and he was an aerospace guy and he was driving the bus at that point. So it's been that cycle up and down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have a friend who works for the Navy and he does research for the Navy. And he said, you know, back in the day, you know, we would have a new fighter every 10 years. We would have a new fighter. And he said, now in terms of the cycles, we'll design a new fighter probably twice in my lifetime.
Uh-huh, I see.
So we're just not churning out new thing after new thing after new thing anymore because there's no point to it. Like, we're not probably going to fight Russia in a war, but what we have to do is fight all these IEDs and these sort of low-tech engagements.
Yeah, different kind of war, different kind of...
Yeah. So then, what was your thinking about... So why did you decide to transfer to Valley?
You know, I don't know. It was close. I will admit it was closer to home. I was living in Reseda at the time. It was Valley College, my alma mater, and that had an attraction. There's no question about it. I knew people there who really needed an instructor. They said, we really needed a second instructor, a third instructor. And so that was it. I decided to make the change. And I'm glad I did. I'm very glad I'm back at Valley. And I retired officially 7 years ago. But I've been teaching ever since. As I mentioned, I was the former department chair when it was much larger than it is now. It was computer science as well as electronics. It was third largest department on campus when we merged with computer science. But then we broke off of that. It's not that anymore at all. But so I have some familiarity with how things operate on campus like that. You know.
Well, when you first came here, how did Valley College feel different? Or did
different
it feel the same?
It was more or less, Trade Tech was Trade Tech. By that, I mean, it had a good reputation and everything was modular. So a student would sign up for 13 units, actually, to take a physics class too. They'd be in class for 24 hours a week. And that was no choice. You had to, it was a module and virtually all the trades were like that: electrical, electronics, drafting, architecture, fashion design, all of that. So students were full time. You had no choice. And again, we had 18 full time instructors. We had a massive program in electronics. So when I came to Valley, it was not like that at all. It was two other instructors, three of us together. We had more classes offered then than we do now. Quite a few more, but it wasn't anything like Trade Tech in that regard.
Well, I guess we should have probably said this in the beginning. What is the difference between electronics, engineering, and computers? Because they seem related, but But how are they sort of different?
Yeah, well, I tell my students in electronics, for example, that take all the programming courses you can. Anything you can fit in the basic programming courses, anything like that, you will need that. When I go to computer science classes to talk to them about taking an electronics class, I cannot make that claim in reverse and don't. I say it would be nice if you took an electronics course and we opened up that box and you could see what integrated circuits really look like, and we can do talk about some logic, and you can build some logic circuits and so on and so forth. But it's not absolutely necessary for your career. But the opposite is true with electronics again. So much of what we're doing in electronics involves programming of various kinds at various levels, down to the machine level at sometimes and so on and so forth. So that's one aspect. Again, electronics, take as many programming courses as you can. There are degree programs which are in computer science, of course. There are those in electrical engineering, double E in electrical engineering, and there are computer electronics. So there's a mixed bag. Some four-year colleges definitely understand that a student would be better off merging both electricity or electronics, if you will, and computer science. Schools are now picking up on what's called a megatronics, which is a combination of mechanics and electronics. Many schools offer a course or two in that, but some four-year colleges offer a bachelor's degree in mechatronics. One of them being Cal State Channel Island. Cal State Channel Island has a program like that, which is kind of interesting.
I guess for people who are like wondering, the computer programmer works on the part that you can't touch in a computer. It's mostly typing, right? But the electronics is the thing that you can actually touch in the computer.
And again, for the megatronics, not to change the subject, I really don't think I am. For example, robotics, people who are, say, I'm interested in robotics. Well, clearly, robotics requires knowledge and skills in three areas: mechanics, electronics, and programming. And so, and there are indeed few colleges that offer a bachelor's degrees in robotics.
But when you were mentioning that, because there's not a lot of robotic, like you said, that's usually a master's degree, and my son likes to do robotics. So when you were talking about that combination of electronics, mechanical, and programming, that seems to be something that fits him really well. And then how is computer engineering different from, let's say, electronics?
Well, again, I'm not, believe it or not, I'm not as familiar with that lately as I should be, perhaps. But there will be an emphasis on programming, with some electronics thrown in, that sort of thing. Or the other way around, more electronics. At Cal State LA, it would be more electronics and some programming thrown in or put in there, if you will. So,
and then in terms of how CTE is created at Valley College, so how is this actually organized? So you do not get an A. Do you have an AA in electronics?
Do we offer one? Are you saying? Absolutely. It's an AS degree. We offer an AS degree in electronics in two areas now. One is a general technician AS degree, and then one in biomedical electronics. We are the only community college in Southern California and one of only two community colleges in all of California that offers an associate degree and a certificate in biomedical instrumentation, where you repair and maintain hospital equipment. And it's very popular, and the jobs are there, and we're the only ones that still offer one in Southern California.
And then what's the difference between the license and the AS then?
Or the certificate, you mean?
On the certificate, yes.
Well, the answer is very straightforward and simple. The certificate requires the electronics courses. The associate degree requires the electronics courses plus your GE courses, plus your 18 units of GE and 5 units of elective.
Oh, okay. And then what's the opportunity difference?
And let me explain it this way. I tell my students, look, you will never have to explain an associate degree to anybody, what it is and so forth. If you do, that's the wrong person. You're talking to the wrong person. Almost everybody will hire and know what's going on. They know an associate degree is a 2-year college degree that requires 60 units. But you will always need to explain a certificate because the certificates are all over the place. Some of them are only 12 units. Some we at Valley, we don't right now, but there was a time when we had 3 certificates that were 42 units. Now most of them are 32 or 34 units. So you'll always have to explain that. And I think my students understand that. And so I always encourage them. I said, look, get your certificate and get your degree. They're not mutually exclusive. They are supportive. What students will usually do is one of two things. They'll take the certificate courses in electronics, and then in the winter session or the summer sessions, they'll try to squeeze in one of the GE courses, looking for 18 units. Usually it's 6 courses, 3-unit courses. Or they'll just go through and get the certificate, and then they'll come back and get the start taking the GE courses. Some, of course, don't come back and get the degree, but I strongly urge it for the reasons I just mentioned.
And then I always see your students hanging out in front of your building. It seems to be a real like community and culture around the electronics building.
Yeah, well, that's interesting because we do have some nursing classes in there. Maybe that's part of it.
I don't know. They're all guys. I always see like yeah. I always feel like I see the electronics yeah. hanging out together.
Yeah, well, that's good. Yeah, they we do. We try to make them feel part of the department. I have one story. I remember when I was doing some work for one of the administrators, and it involved stuffing envelopes. I'm talking about hundreds. And so I'm in the building. This was in the old physics building. And I'm doing that, and I'm saying, there's got to be a better way. I got to get some help. So I walked out into the quad area, and I saw 2 kids sitting around. And I said, look, if you come in and help me fold stuff these envelopes, I'll buy you a Coke. Whoa, how could they refuse such a thing? So they wandered in, and they did. And one of them started talking to me and said, well, what's going on here? And I said, well, you know what we're doing in this electronics. And I said, what are you majoring in? He says, I don't know. I just got here, and I don't know what I want to do. 2 years later, John, I went to his graduation where he got an associate science degree in electronics.
Well, I've sent students to your class and they love it, right? I mean, you have the beginning that, what's the class that you, what number is
well,
it?
They will take EL2. They want to take what's called EL2. And this one said, oh, what happened to EL1? I said, I don't know. It's kind of like channel one on this. There's no EL1, but EL2 is a hands-on activity oriented class. It's 3 units. And as you know, John, from my visiting your classes with my projects and all the kits that were and the circuits we're building and so on, it's hands-on. And fortunately, we've been able to continue that online here. I haven't sacrificed that one bit. They get a package at the bookstore, cost them $15, and they've got over $100 worth of stuff in it, and it's all theirs to keep, including a meter and so on. And they build circuits. My philosophy is simple. You learn electronics by doing electronics. Now, if you don't like that approach to an introductory course in electronics, you can take it elsewhere in the district where there's nothing but theory. They never touch an electronic component. They never build anything, never see anything. It's all theory. I won't tell you where that is, but anyway, so we do a lot of that. We do a lot of hands-on stuff, and I assume no prior knowledge of electronics. And yeah, I think the students enjoy it. You know, many of these students, they went through they went through their Lego stage where they started, they built Legos when they were young kids and so on. And then they just drifted off and they went into to video games and so forth. But they haven't built anything that works and that they can get the pride and satisfaction with them. I have three students today. I've talked to three separate students on Zoom today, helping them with their first full project here. And they got it working, and they were so excited. And I understand that. I understand. It worked. It worked. I can't believe it.
Let me just tell you. Go ahead, Scott.
I was just going to ask, what does that project look like, Ron? So, I mean, I think, like you said, the satisfaction of doing something like that and seeing the finished product and seeing it working is really huge. Can you describe what the project is?
Well, I will. There are two different ones that we've done in the past. I've got them right here at my desk. I was going to show them to you, but we're not doing video. And the first one that they're doing now is just what's called an LED flasher. It flashes two LEDs alternately. But they have to build it from a schematic. That involves an integrated circuit, a couple of resistors, a couple of LEDs, the capacitor. They have to wire it up right and so on and so forth. But the other project I'm looking at right here is this little mini Tesla coil, which it's a cute little Tesla coil that actually works as a Tesla coil. You can bring a fluorescent bulb near it and it will light by holding it in your hand. Wow. They love that puppy. But we didn't build that this semester. But it's either that one or the other one as a first project. They will build others.
Let me tell you, I steal from Ron constantly. So this is what happens. Ron will email me and say, can I talk to your class and show them, tell them to join my Electronics 2 class. And he'll come in, and he has all these electronics that spin, that do all kinds of just like fancy things, that move, that spin, that light. And my whole class is wild. And then he always grabs like three or four students who have nothing to do with electronics or engineering or anything. And they just said it was great. And then what I do is anytime, because Ron is always adding to his collection. And what I do is whatever is cool, I steal it and I put it in my son's or my daughter's school project. So when he talks about a Tesla coil, what a Tesla coil is, if you put a light bulb near it, just a light bulb, you're not even plugging it in. You hold the light bulb near it, it turns on, right? So it's basically electricity in the air, and it will turn on things that are near it. So for my daughter, she had to make a Harry Potter project. So we built a giant Tesla coil, and she just said, this is my magic little Harry Potter thing. And she had a magic wand. She put these little lights near them, and they all lit up. And the kids go, wow. Yeah, so we've been doing it every year for 8 years. So when I go to my students' office hours, because we're known for it now, they always ask me, like, who are you and where do you get these ideas? And I tell them, I don't tell them anything. I go, oh, they're just mine.
Yeah.
But really.
That's okay.
I steal from Ron every year. Yeah. So every time Ron comes in, he shows me the new electronics things that he has his students build. Me and my son and my daughter, we go make it.
Great. That's great. You're right, John. I put all of these projects on a 6x9-inch clipboard. I have over 100 now. And some of them are really quite sophisticated. I look forward, John, to coming in your class in real time and showing you some of the newer stuff that's come out that I built. And the students do.
I can't wait because my students love it. And you always get a few from my class. They always come back and say it's great.
Yeah, I do. No, my recruiting is, yes. And everybody in the math department has been extremely accommodating in that regard. And I will usually, what's happened, I usually go out to, 12 or 13 math classes. I'd also go to astronomy and astronomy and maybe one other class, but 90% of them are the math classes, and they're always accommodating and welcoming. And my class is full. Class is full.
Ron, I got another question for you, kind of a different nature here. And you mentioned it in describing sort of some of your earlier work at Trade Tech, where you were doing technical writing and then textbook writing. You're also known as a accomplished author with a number of different books. Can you share a little bit about how you transitioned from that technical writing and textbook writing to some of the other writing that you did?
Yeah, well, okay. When I was technical writing, a friend of mine, Kim Badrigan, who I'd known as a teacher and so on, came by to have lunch with me. This was back in 1983 or so. And what he did is he came by and he showed me this brochure, this 9 by 12 brochure, colored brochure, fold out of a book he had written, a textbook in electronics. And I said to myself, not to him, but to myself, I said, oh, Kim, if Kim can write a book, why can't I? And that's the beginning. And so I wrote 6 textbooks in electronics. A couple of them were lucky enough to go into future editions and so forth. But I didn't stop there. Later on, I got into careers, looking at careers, and I wrote a book called The Everything Hot Careers Book. And that was published in 2000, I think, or 2001. And then I didn't stop there. And I've written, and again, I don't usually talk much about this, but I've written 18 young adult YA nonfiction books on a variety of subjects, from Buffalo Bill Cody to African-Americans in the Civil War to the New York subway system and so on. These are library books. They're well-bound. They look good. Whether you think the writing's any good or not is another matter, but the quality, the publisher's quality of these books have been quite good. I wrote 3 books for the middle grade books, one on Christopher Columbus, one on the U.S. Congress, and one on Henry Ford. And then I wanted to do one on Tesla, but I got a little, I don't know, I just felt it was time to put it back for a while or pull back from that for a while. Publishing industry has changed a lot, but I'm very I'm pleased with my books and I'm pleased with having done them. And so, yeah.
Mm-hmm. How do you get your research on it?
Yeah, people ask me that carefully. I make up most of the stuff, you know. No, nobody knows. Nobody cares. Nobody checks it out. You know, there are ways, of course, to start out with. I do start out with the internet, looking at sources and so on, and reading some of the primary sources and some of the secondary sources, and find out what their sources were, what their footnotes say, and I'll go to those books and so forth. Again, these are about 25 to 30,000 words, those smaller books. It take, you know, it take a few months, 4 months, 3 to 4 months to write one.
And are you sort of directed and just driven by what your interests are? So if you had a particular interest in you know, the New York subway or Buffalo Bill Cody, then you would sort of just follow that interest for writing it?
In fact, yes. In fact, well, I was interviewed by the school paper, the Valley College school paper once, and he asked me, the interviewer said, well, you know, you write what you know. And I said, no, I write what I want to know. And so writers are told always, write what you know. But if it's a subject I'm interested in, I do that. One of the publisher at one point said, look, we've got a guy who was supposed to write a book for us on the World Trade Organization, but he's bowed out. Would you be willing to take it over? We'd really appreciate it. It's my philosophy is basically say yes and then figure out how to do it later. So I said, yeah, I'll do that. And I got off the, I don't know whether it was. Can't remember whether it was on the phone or email or whatever, but I got off and I said to myself, what the hell is the World Trade Organization? Is that the World Trade Center? No, the World Trade Organization. Wasn't that something going on in Seattle in 1996? There was some kind of... Well, I wrote it, and as I was writing it, about a couple months in, I wrote to my editor and I said, you know, I'm going to finish this book for you and I'm going to do a good job. But it's a bit out of, it's a challenge. And she said, Ron, it's always a good idea to work out of your comfort zone. And I told her, I said, I'm always working out of my comfort zone. But I think it was, quite frankly, I think it was one of the better books I've written. So you never know, you know, say yes and then figure out how to do it. What the hell? So that's it.
So Ron, if you were going to give a student who was going to make a career in electronics, what advice would you give them?
Okay. Well, obviously, you need to take the right courses. And quite, John, you're going to like this. Just as you can take as much computer science as you can take. You should take as much math as you can. However, it depends. If you want to be a technician level, you don't have to go into the advanced math and so forth. So don't let the math scare you. If you want to work at that level, if you want to be a double E, you're going to have to get through your math. But what I would say to them, and what's so easy to do now, and what's so important, is to gain in the informal education in electronics by doing electronics. There are so many ways in which you can play with electronics, build things, test things, troubleshoot on your own, in your own room, in your own house, whatever. As we've been showing, that's the informal way to learn, and you will learn. There are websites galore, there are magazines galore, there are electronic components and equipment. It's never been cheaper. You get more for a penny or a dollar. You can buy LEDs now for a penny a piece. When I first started with them 40 years ago, they were 20 cents a piece then, which was equivalent to a couple of bucks. So you can get all this stuff cheap, easy, and so forth. And I'm looking on my wall now that I just put it up here. We had a student, Mohammed, in our class. He took all our electronics classes, some mechanical, and he worked for me as a student, paid student assistant. Okay, I wish I could show you this. He emails me yesterday this picture. I knew this was happening. He got a job working for Lam Research up in Portland, Oregon, a huge company that make ICs. He showed me a picture of him standing there on his first day of training in a clean suit. You know,
oh, wonderful!
He's making $32 an hour to start, plus an $800 a month bonus for working the night shift. This guy's going to make close to $75,000 work for the first year, and he's working for a major company. They're going to pay his. For any future education he wants. I wish I could hold this up and show you his picture. It's so cute. And he got it all himself. He got the job himself. He went, and they were glad to get him. He went up to Oregon. He knew nobody there. Found himself a little room to stay at somebody's house, rent some room, and he's off and running. So there are opportunities. There are things you can do.
Oh, that's great.
That is great. What a success story.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Ron, thank you so much for sharing, your path to Valley College and all the kind of stops along the way. And it's really interesting to find out more about the electronics department too. I'm sure what you shared is going to, pique the interest of the listeners and coming by and seeing how they can get enrolled in those classes.
Okay. Well, wonderful. I'm glad you gave me the opportunity to talk to you. Students can email me, of course, at reisra@lavc.edu, or just start typing my name in and you can get it and ask me any questions they want. And we'll take it from there. And I look forward to seeing them in EL2 in the fall.
Thanks, Ron. I really appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you, Scott. And thank you, John.
Thank you.